This is for the nerds, this is for the brainiacs, this is what we deserve. Go ahead and play it back, you ain't gonna touch me, you not gonna do nothing, you are not above me, I bet you wish you was me, I know that I know.
What is poppin', everybody? And welcome back to another special episode of the Only Friends Podcast. Well, you know, it's me and my only friends, which includes, but is not limited to, Matthew Hunt.
Hey, Conrad.
Wow. How are you doing today, Mr. Hunt?
I'm doing very well. How are
you? Full name.
I'm good. I'm chilling. You know, it's another day in paradise.
Yeah.
It's real nice out today. It's not hot at all.
I like this time of year. It's not like hot.
Time
it's
of year?
Hot. It's warm enough that I, you know, it's not cold, but I can still go outside.
Well, last week was insane because it went from like 60 to 95 in the matter of an hour.
That's true, it did. It's like, this is what the city is like now.
It was just absolutely crazy, and now it's back to like 70. So it's
I'm having a hard time finding a window of time to walk the dogs where it won't kill Gatsby. It's very, I mean,
5 a.m.?
No, absolutely not.
Wait, you still take Gatsby out for walks?
Have to.
I thought his hips were shot.
Yeah, that's why you got to walk him so he doesn't get stiff.
I thought it was the opposite.
No. He's struggling to get in and out of the doggy door now because I haven't walked him in like 5 days. But I'm going to start doing like more aquatic therapy with him, which requires me getting in the pool.
Oh, man. We're going to have to
not looking forward to
you're
it.
You're going to actually have to use the pool?
It's fine because I need to teach Pip how to swim anyway.
That's true.
So the timing kind of works out pretty well, but... she feels great about the prospects.
Well,
I don't understand anything about how this dog sleeps.
You had to see her the other day. Like, I have a mat for her at the other place,
yeah.
And it's like a mat, whatever, and it's pretty big. And she sleeps literally only her back legs are on the mat. Everything else on the hard
it's
floor.
It's so weird. Like yesterday or last night, I guess she was really really wound up. When I brought her home, like super zoomy, which makes sense because I ended up not leaving here after the pod and ended up working till like 11. So I didn't really get to exercise her much, just a little bit of running around outside. So she's super zoomy when we get home and then she just crashes, right? Of course, no big deal. And for the most part, she sleeps in one of two spots. If Gatsby's not in my bed, she'll sleep in his area, which is like the lower right hand foot. And if he is in my bed, she'll sleep like much closer to me. And she tends to like need to touch me, but like never anything too invasive.
Yeah.
Last night, for whatever reason, she like ran into my bed, like sprinted into my bed, like full zoomy, and then just collapses with her entire weight across my chest. So her like beak was nestled into my neck, and it didn't matter how I moved. She found a way to get back there. I ended up just like sleeping like that for 6 hours until like she had to finally go out. I was like, okay, I mean, you got to cherish these days. You know, they get
you
big
do
so
you
fast.
Do, yeah.
Or she's going to try to do this when she's 100 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. That's
100%.
That's the concern, I guess.
Yeah.
It took Gatsby a while to... Gatsby used to sleep like nose to nose with me. And it probably took him until he was like 4 or 5 before he actually wanted his own space.
All dogs are like, they're all lap dogs at one point, right? When they're puppies, they just, you know, and then they grow out of it, but they don't grow out of it.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's kind of adorable.
Yeah, it is.
Apologies for the technical difficulties on the first stream. Just had an immediate crash, had to re-upload, but you're all here now. Hopefully you found us, since then, I imagine. Everybody will make their way here at some point or another, but
YouTube will tell them where to go.
That's right. It's all about the fucking algo.
As long as we
pay
like,
homage,
like, subscribe, hit the bell,
tell them, LeMay.
It will definitely tell
auto
you
auto jump you right
yeah.
to the stream.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just do that.
How much money do we have to give Savage for few extra tickets to this thing?
I think. Look, he was sending me. I was getting updates before Landon was getting updates. he had me locked in at this final table. Whenever it was playing down, so I think he's going to be pretty generous about letting us bring the ruckus.
Okay.
May 29th, if you guys are in Vegas, it's going to be a spectacle. Landon Tice going for his first WPT championship, which would be the first in this household in spite of many close calls.
Everyone bring a towel.
Bring your red towel.
Only a towel.
Only your red towel. Imagine we all showed up like just in red towels. We're like, we're here for the long hair.
I don't think like we're doing it.
I don't think they're letting us in, buddy.
Tell them we came from the pool.
Yeah, we're just doing it, man.
I don't expect us to get lit in. Also, for what it's worth, it's in the Hypersports Arena.
It's freezing.
Freezing. Freezing.
I mean, we did talk about commitment to the bit, right?
Yeah.
Whatever your idea of extremely cold is, take it down 10 degrees because it's so frigid.
After 10 beers, you can't feel anything.
Well, that's true. LaManna. Nobody knows how to rail a final table like Brian LaManna. I will put that out there.
I gotta tell you, I've been watching old main events because I do that every now and again. 2011, were on Phil Collins' rail,
right.
And you were on the footage so much. Like they did these little skits with you grilling steaks. You know, like they had you on the rail, like you leading all the Phil Collins songs. Like
commit to the bit,
great.
Man.
Yeah, LaManna was the. What were those the people that
the conductor?
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. Man, he got the in there night chant
right.
going.
Like as soon as they got down to like the final four tables, and from that point on, you were on like every episode. Like there was LaManna, like a wild LaManna just appears on every episode.
Like, literally every time he won a hand, whether it was stealing the buns or whatever,
right,
it was. And then everyone starts singing.
Yeah. Honestly, things have changed so much since then. And from my personal perspective, for the better. Oh, my God, Amato, this is great.
That's amazing.
Very well done, sir. But back then, you know, everything was so brand new. Like, every time somebody made a deep run in something, it was the first of its kind.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Phil was the first person. Actually, I guess I went deep in the main the year prior.
Nick
but
Mamone.
Nick Mamone also the year prior. But the same thing, like, I made day 7, so there's still fucking 5 tables left, and these guys are all filling the rails. So,
it was day 5 when we showed up for Phil, and literally was there every day until all the way to the... So he made it.
Right. It was like such a big deal, and it was such a once in a lifetime, or we thought it was a once in a lifetime or once in a career type opportunity, that everything was the first of its kind. So we all showed up in droves.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's like somebody makes a final table and I'm like, all right, like when there's 3 left, if you don't chop, I'll be there.
I mean, go ahead.
Okay. Imagine showing up to someone's rail on day 5 now. When there's like 250 left, you're like, come on. You're like, you've got like a 20-person rail with 200 players
And you're guaranteed like $36,000.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
3.5 buy-ins.
We were all in our 20s, right. And it was a reason to, you know, day drink, really.
For sure.
It was just like, oh, well, let's just load up our book bag with beers.
I'm telling you, man.
Just drink all day.
Our era was special. You're never going to see it replicated. Like, we were fresh out of college. We were all bringing that, like, college mindset to this. The game was so young then. With like online booming, and not in the way that it is now. Like if you play online, you're a very specific archetype,
mm-hmm.
right? Like you fit the basement dweller. Shout out to all my online crushers out there, but like, you know, I'm not telling you anything you don't already know. You know, you haven't seen the light of day in quite some time. You're not going to show up on day 5 of the main to day drink with your boys.
Like the goal was to have a crew, like someone go deep, everybody go nuts for them. Like it was so much fun.
Yeah. Yeah,
yeah. It was like, and it was just like, get on TV, and you're right, yeah.
Yeah, the TV aspect was a big deal. Remember the guy who, they made a rule for him after the fact.
The Screaming Swede?
No. He used to bark.
Oh, yeah.
He was literally barking just to get on a feature table, and eventually they obviously put him on a feature table. He got patched up. He made money off of it, and then the following year, they were just like, no unnecessary antics.
Right.
That was Havad Khan, right? Yeah.
Havad Khan was doing the... So they made the Havad Khan rule, but it was actually with regard to, I think, being in hands. Mm. Like, you can't be disruptive while you're in hands.
He's on bark while you're in the middle of
the
hand.
He was doing the bulldozer thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then standing up and giving the old 1-2s.
Yeah, I mean, like we've mentioned this before, but it was like if you got on a feature table during like the main event, like it was worth like $10,000 minimum.
Minimum,
right? So it was just like, oh yeah, sure, I'll just bark until they put me on TV because it's worth $10,000.
Right.
Right?
Right, like, yeah.
That's so insane.
People have done a lot more for a lot less.
There's a lot of interesting old coverage. You'll see when you go back, I can't remember if it was the year I went deep in 2010 or maybe the year Phil went deep. One of those early years, somewhere between 2010 and 2013, there's a lot of coverage of the Blazarian brothers. So Adam and Dan were getting a ton of coverage, and it was before Blitz was Blitz.
Right.
Like, he was just this clean-shaven, random kid from Florida that nobody knew anything about. And then, you know, fast forward 5 years later, and all of a sudden, he's, like, the biggest thing in, you know, poker and whatever, fucking Instagram, I don't know.
I think those main events are not on PokerGo. I look back on archive. Yeah, I think it must be something like ESPN still has the rights or something, because PokerGo has, like, they have a bunch of really old ones, like from like the 70s when poker was first televised with no hole cards. Mm-hmm. And then they have 2011 onwards, but they don't have like that 90s through 2010
period. That's strange, because I did a series for them. I think it was called,
I remember, yeah,
something 2020, Hindsight 2020. And the majority of the final tables that we re-reviewed were between Moneymaker and 2020.
I mean, it's possible I was just looking in the wrong place, but like,
it might just be like out of sorts.
Yeah, maybe they just need to sort their archive better or something. Yeah. But when I looked through the archive of like old main events that they have in the WSOP category, it goes back to 2011 and then it just stops. So like, they're in some other category.
They might have put it free on their YouTube.
Oh, that's possible.
That could be. That's possible. I feel pretty confident that they own the rights.
That would make sense, because I remember that show you did. Yeah.
Yeah. That was a fun show, man. It was perfect timing too, because it was during the pandemic. I wish we could do something like that again now, because I wasn't very sharp with MTT tools back then, so I couldn't do ICM stuff. Even now, I wouldn't be like great at it, but I could outsource it to Landon pretty easily.
Yeah.
Could you be like, all right, give me the ICM of all this?
Oh, and man, go way back and just watch like the ICM torches.
Bro, it's insane. Like, I didn't need a calculator to do of these. Yeah, there was one where like Dan Harrington just like yeeted off like 60 big blinds with like 8-3 offsuit.
It's the it's the classic example. It's the like squeeze play example that he gives in his book, I think, where he has a stack of like 2 million. And it goes like open to 150 or something, call, and he has 6 deuce off, and he makes it 1 million.
Yeah.
And then everybody folds. But you get jammed on, what are you doing?
Right, exactly.
Like, are you just folding for half your
100% time? 100% he is. 100%. That's why, that's Action Dan, baby.
Yeah,
Action Dan,
I mean, I know,
he's earned that nickname.
Yeah, it's just a funny classic hand.
He's a fascinating person to like go back and look in hindsight, because I think like we don't give enough credit to how much brain solving was taking place back then because we didn't have tools. So Harrington on Hold'em was very revolutionary for its time.
Mm-hmm.
And mainly just because it actually modeled some semblance of a system that was applicable in real time. So obviously M-Theory proved to not be that great when it was all said and done. It's pretty egregious to just be like open ripping 30 bigs, but you know, there are some spots for it.
Yeah.
Sure. But in any event, like what it categorically allowed for was, without getting to the underlying or the underpinning math, being able to model something in some sort of capacity and say like, okay, when you have this blinds, like this, subset of blinds, your strategy is to be all in.
Mm-hmm.
When you're twice as deep, your strategy is to three bet all in. When you're three times as deep, your strategy is to like raise and steal. And you know, basically all this was predicated on how many antes and blinds you had before you just broomcorn's uncle, anteed yourself to death. And I think like he probably doesn't get nearly enough credit for being so far ahead of his time. I can remember like I just read it and I was just like, oh, you get to be really aggressive. I'm in for this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm fucking in.
Yeah.
And I remember playing a tournament at one of the local Seneca casinos where I had ace queen off, I think in like the hijack or something like that. And I had 4M. But 4M was like 22 bigs.
Mm-hmm.
So I just open rip, because that's what you do when you're sub 5M.
Right.
I just open rip. And I'll never forget this. Who was the guy that cashed the main event with one chip that played in our room at Salamanca?
Oh yes,
I want to say his name's Billy, but I feel like that's not right. Anyway, it doesn't really matter. Yeah. I think it might have been Billy. Anyway, he was like on the button or whatever, or maybe he was in the big blind. I don't remember. But when it was all said and done, he's just like, I mean, I don't know what you're doing, but I can't call. And he shows ace king.
Yeah.
And it was just like, oh, this is fucking genius. This guy knows exactly what he's talking about. But back then, like, you know, nobody had a fucking clue.
Right. I remember. I mean, one of the early epiphanies of my poker journey in the first like 6 months of trying to learn poker was basically discovering that you can just jam for 10 bigs and people will fold. You know, I remember jamming like some random 10-4 off or something on the button for 10 bigs, which is like bad, but it was in a sit and go. And I remember getting called by Ace King and just winning with like 10-4 off and being like, oh shit, this is great. Cause if they fold, I win the pot. And sometimes I win the pot even when they don't fold.
I told my parents that this was like, you know, they were playing like these little like dailies, these $50, $60 days when they'd come to Vegas to stay at Bally's. And, you know, I would be like, when you have 10 big blinds or less, like don't raise, just go all in. Mm. And then like, they printed because of it.
Yeah.
They literally just that. My dad's like, the 10 big blind rule. It's the greatest thing ever.
Imagine little Mary just like open ripping. You're shaking in your boots.
Right. And then, like literally like, you know, these are literally the softest tournaments in Vegas, all amateurs, and nobody's doing that. So like them knowing that like concept, just like they would always make the final table, money and just like did really well.
I think that really highlights something that is so special to our era that maybe Conrad might even be like a little bit too late to the game to really, although the games that he came up in, it probably still applied, but we were just tasked with trying to outmaneuver the way the collective thought. Exactly. And that's very applicable today too. The problem is that the collective is a lot more educated. Right. So they have much more underpinning in or a better understanding of theory in general, which makes it a little bit more difficult to navigate in a very exploitative way. And I think that's where people get confused. They talk about theory versus exploits. And I think the majority of the definition of exploitative play is abandoning theory and just doing whatever it is that makes the most amount of money versus a specific action that your opponent takes. And that used to be true, but it wasn't because abandoning theory is the correct way to exploit. It's because we didn't understand theory.
Right.
It wasn't there to begin with.
People think that GTO or theory or whatever is somehow doing something other than trying to make the most money.
Right.
Like,
right.
And then when they say, oh, I play exploitatively, what they mean is I try to make the most money.
Right.
And they think that people who are playing quote-unquote GTO are somehow doing something other than trying to make the most money.
Right.
It's like an absurd assumption.
Back then, like, exploiting people was like so simple, like simplified. Like the exploits were so simple.
It was so obvious. And, everything was so obvious.
But like if you found a good one that worked, you'd just rise right to the top of pocket fives.
Yeah.
You were just like, you were just absolutely crushed because nobody knew what you were doing. And you were just like, these exploits were massive, absolutely massive. And if you found a good one, you're just printing.
It's the Sam Grafton tweet where he talks about every year what the special thing at WSOP was.
Right.
And it ends with like Ethereum or something. Like it ends with like a joke, right? But it's all about each year. It's like open raising wide, then three betting wide, four betting wide, et cetera. Every year there's a progression. And now we're getting to a point where we've gone through all those iterations and we're back towards some kind of equilibrium because there's no more easy exploits that you can just do this and no one will figure it out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know what I mean? I mean, for me personally, where I immediately lost the passion for tournament poker was when people really started to comprehend preflop charts. Once that happened, my ability to create kind of like went out the window because prior to that, I could execute a mix of limps and raises and the response was just all over the place, right? Like it was insane to see that I could voluntarily limp from early position.
It was such a good strategy for the time.
It was so amazing because it made people's brain break. Like I would limp early position and then a good player or a reg would be in middle position, have a hand that they would never VPIP if it had folded to them, and then decide to ISO. Like, they just have ace 8 off in the hijack that they would never fucking open if it folded to them.
Yeah, look at all that free money in there. You're just limping around.
Right, but because I limp, they're just like, oh, this is like, it's like the way straddles used to impact cash games. Somebody would put the straddle on, and then everybody next to act would just be like, oh, I have to open no matter what because like there's extra money out there. Mm-hmm. It's just like, well, that's definitely not how this game works.
That's the tweet right there. I love that tweet.
Yeah, it's incredible.
A Hall of Fame poker tweet. 1,400 likes for a reason right there.
Mm-hmm. Very, very good tweet. Before we get into, I mean, this is already carrying into our bigger Strat Chat discussion today, but before we do all of that, I got to get some heavy lifting out of the way. I want to remind you guys that I'll be in Milwaukee next week. We're headed to Pottawatomie. Their grand opening of their poker room is May 2nd. We're going to be having a big meetup game. Myself, Jamie Kerstetter, Jamin Burton, we're all going to be there. We're going to be splashing around, a little bit of No Limit, a little bit of PLO, a lot of low stakes, 1-3-2-5. Papa Tom is going to be in the building as well. So Tom Wheaton's going to be there. It's going to be an above the felt Pottawatomie casino partnership.
I would have said it's Pottawatomie. That sounds right to me. I don't know if that's true.
It's not.
Pottawatomie.
Let me tell you guys what it is. Hold on.
Okay, let's hear it.
Pottawatomie?
You're very close.
That's actually pretty good, Conrad.
Put it in Google Translate. That's always my option.
Trust me, I did.
Oh, that's what you did, and it gave you Pottawatomie? Okay.
I was pretty confident in Pottawatomie to begin with.
It went to YouTube translation.
And then Tom came back with Pottawatomie. And I was like, no, I'm very sure that's not it. So we put it through Google Translate. And also, there was an indigenous woman who made a video. she's very Michigan. So it's funny because she's both Native American, but also has the Midwestern Minnesota Michigan twang.
A fun mix. Yeah.
And it was just like, okay, so we say Pottawatomie. And I was like, I trust this lady.
Pottawatomie.
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 This is how white people say it. Okay. You find my lady on YouTube.
You'd
trust her too. That's how Tom was pronouncing it. Pottawatomie or Pottawatomie? It's Pottawatomie. At the end of the day, it's Pottawatomie. I finally got one right. Let me fucking have this.
You can have it, of course. I don't know why my brain went to like the last O being like O. I don't know why my brain did that. Maybe it's a British English thing.
Well, you just thought Berkey would be honestly wrong, which
well,
was
that was
usually
that too.
Correct.
Well, yeah, that's very fair. And truthfully, there's so many syllables. I think you can just kind of freestyle this one. You know, whatever syllable you want to emphasize here, let's just go for it.
Once there's more than X number of syllables, you just get to freestyle.
You get to
pick
whatever one you want.
That should be a rule.
Anything over three syllables, you can put the emphasis on whichever portion of the word you like.
Yeah.
You want it to be on the me? That's fine.
That's fair.
You want it to be on the pot? That's fine too.
Pottawatomie.
All right. If you want to give the Luigi pronunciation, there you go. But yeah, if you guys are in the area, be sure to stop by. I guess this room has been closed since COVID. So the local area has been frothing at the bit to get back out there and gamble. And we're ready to bring it for them.
They got you out there and all these you're hosting all kinds of meetups.
I'm just Midwest traveling, baby.
You're out there meet and greet.
They're smart. They take me to places that have baseball stadiums I haven't been to.
There's a lot of them in the Midwest.
Okay. Yeah. There are a lot of them in the Midwest. St. Louis is probably next.
Yeah, that one's further away than of all compared to all the other ones, right? You can get to like Detroit and Milwaukee and Chicago.
There are a couple things that I'm very surprised by and a little bit embarrassed by. Number one was that I didn't do the RV baseball stadium tour with you guys.
That was so much fun.
Honestly, I would have been much more inclined if you guys would have done an East Coast travel instead of a Midwest one.
Mm-hmm.
You guys went to Cleveland,
Detroit.
Well,
we were already in the Midwest.
Fuck you.
My man. I couldn't help myself. I had to
end it in the Northeast. But yeah, you guys went from Erie to Cleveland to Detroit to Chicago.
We didn't go to Cleveland. Maybe we went to Cleveland.
You didn't go to Jacobs? How could you not?
I think because the schedule didn't allow for it.
Oh.
They were out of town or something like that.
Oh, I see.
No, we went to Detroit, and then we went from Detroit to...
Both Chicago's.
To Chicago, up to Milwaukee, then down to St. Louis, then over to Indianapolis to watch... opening.
AAA?
What's that?
For AAA?
No.
It was
opening night for NFL. Yes.
Yeah.
It was the year after the Colts had won it.
Yeah.
So they would drop the banners and everything went there. And then we went to Pittsburgh from there.
I met you guys in Pittsburgh for the Pirate game.
And then you guys went
to Penn State.
Penn State for Penn State football
It sounded
game.
Like you spent $100 on baseball tickets total.
Right.
Yeah.
And maybe like $400 on NFL.
Sounds about right.
Yeah.
we actually caught a... We went to... When we were in Chicago, went to Soldier Field for a Bears like preseason game because it was like the week before.
Yeah. I think
Wrigley
everything
was
you're
awesome.
Saying... Honestly, I've been to Wrigley.
Yeah.
Everything you're saying, none of that appeals to me. I mean, the baseball stadiums do, but like of all the baseball stadiums I haven't seen, the ones that you just crossed off the list are like the least desirable for me to go see. If you guys would have went like Boston to New York to New York to Baltimore to Washington and like down the East Coast like that, yeah, I would have been so fucking in.
Yeah. I mean, the East Coast is pretty far from you guys, so you know.
I hate you
it's
so
just,
much.
It's just, you know, it's hard. The RV doesn't, you know, RV in New York City is, that's not something we wanted to deal with.
Yeah, that's fair. That's
cool. It's hard enough trying to find a place to park that thing anyways. So.
Yeah. No, that's
we literally slept in the parking lot of Milwaukee, of the
as
Brewers,
you should,
of the Brewers Day. And we're like, are they going to make us leave? We're like, we just, why?
You paid.
Instead of trying to find a place to go, we'll just stay here.
Yeah. You already paid.
The you know, like the Zamboni or the fake Zamboni, the ones that sweep the parking
street
lot.
Sweepers.
Yeah, street sweepers. Yeah.
The Zamboni.
They look like Zambonis, right. They were just like going by and we're the only ones there. But yeah, it was fun.
You would have thought that you degenerates would have wanted a sober Berkey to drive this bus all across America.
Yeah, I know. We wanted you to come.
I know.
You turned it down.
The second thing that I'm very regretful of, and obviously I can still change this, is it's insane to me I haven't been to San Diego or San Francisco's ballpark since we moved out west.
I just went to San Diego's last summer.
Same.
It was amazing. It's really cool. Yeah.
Like, really, really cool.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Those two are very...
Haven't been to AT&T yet.
Those two are very high on priority. I still don't care about any of those Midwest parks. I'm going to go to Milwaukee while I'm there.
You should. Milwaukee's cool.
It's funny. I still would rather go to Wrigley again than go see Milwaukee for the first time, to be quite honest.
Yeah.
But it is what it is. I really want to go to Boston and Baltimore before...
Yeah, I've never been to those either.
Yeah, I mean, they're such historic ballparks, and mm-hmm. I'm afraid that they're going to get torn down.
Man, are they ever going to tear down Fenway?
I hope not.
I don't think
But so. I don't know, man. I've been to Dodger Stadium. That place is a fucking hole.
Yeah.
Like, they should absolutely incinerate it. It's like one of the oldest parks in baseball.
Yeah.
Absolute worst place I've ever spent 3 hours of my life.
Right.
It's
it makes
terrible.
Sense that you would hate it because it's in L.A. And L.A. is your least favorite place.
L.A. is my least favorite place.
It's hard to get around.
But it's just... have you ever been?
Dodger Stadium? Yeah, Dodger Stadium is the only baseball stadium
I've
been to.
Okay, I was going to say, your wife's a fan. Yeah, it just like sits off of the freeway and it's this just like giant concrete gladiator stadium.
I remember getting there and being like, this is the biggest parking lot I've ever fucking 100%. Seen. 100%. Like, literally thousands and thousands mm-hmm. of cars in this parking lot. And I'm like, who designed this? Whose idea was this? Make it some, do it differently.
Anything,
like,
right. just anything. But it's so hard in that city. Like, where are you going to find
what
space?
How do you build something? How do you create space in that city? Right. Like,
yeah.
I do remember the view from inside the stadium being good because you can see like trees and everything in the background. Yeah. Like there's inside the stadium, I thought it was great. It was a really fun place to watch a game. But the whole outside area, like getting in and out, like just it's chaos.
So, it's so crazy. Like if you thought that was like scenic in any capacity, imagine if we took him to PNC. Like the entire outfield just opens up to the skyline of Pittsburgh with the Clemente Bridge going across the river.
I might be a little biased. I mean, I do have a Pirates jersey on, but I mean, I've been to a bunch of stadiums and nothing is compared to
that. See, the thing about my experience with stadiums is because I've only been to soccer and cricket for the most part in the UK, like they don't have like an open end like most baseball stadiums do.
You have just
all enclosed.
Soccer stadiums have four sides, just all enclosed. The cricket stadium is just basically a circle where sometimes they'll have like an open part.
You got to
like,
make sure they get 100,000 people in there.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's Australia.
Yeah.
Australia cricket stadiums, like they've got a couple 100,000 seater stadiums, but like
200,000.
That's so sick.
They've got Australia has, I think the Sydney Cricket Ground and Melbourne Cricket Ground are both 90-ish, 100,000 seater stadiums.
That's kind of like some football
like
stadium. There's like one in like Ann Arbor or something that has like 100,000.
Pretty much all the Big Ten
Michigan
schools.
Michigan,
Penn State, Ohio State.
Sydney is 48K.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Melbourne must be 90 plus then. I thought Sydney was bigger. I know one of them is 90 plus.
It's an experience. Like, I would watch just about anything with another 100,000 people.
Right. Like, going to a Penn State game is wild.
Yeah. Like, you can actually feel, like, the sound reverbing off your body. It's wild.
Yeah. 100,000 people chanting.
I've been to Wembley Stadium as well
looks amazing.
I've been to a soccer game with, like, 90,000 at Wembley, mm-hmm. and I've been to a concert with, like, 100,000 at Wembley.
Just about to say, I think it's insane amazing. That they play concerts there. Like, the acoustics incredible. Have to be wild.
The concert that I saw there was Muse in 2007, and it was one of... Because the stadium... Basically, the stadium got rebuilt in the early 2000s, and it only reopened, I think, in, like, 2004. So Muse, being one of the biggest bands in the UK at the time, their concert that happened there in 2007 was probably one of the biggest concerts that had happened in the UK overall for, like, decades.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it was, like, 100,000 people at Wembley Stadium. To give you an idea of how big they were, the supporting act, or one of the supporting acts, was My Chemical Romance, who in the mid-2000s were huge.
Yeah.
So they supported Muse. So I saw this concert there with like 100,000 people, just incredible, like that many people with the stage at one end, but then the whole like outfield area and all the stands just completely full. Like,
it's like
crazy.
Woodstock with a single stage. And
yeah, it was wild.
It's like going to Taylor Swift out here.
Shut up.
Legion.
Okay.
Really unique experience.
All right, so Strat Chat.
Melbourne is 100K, by the way.
Yeah, 100K. Okay. Yeah, I knew one of them was. I didn't realize only Melbourne was.
Not about to get into another Taylor discussion with Lamanna.
Want to discuss all 31 songs?
No.
Baskin-Robbins, baby.
I've been seeing
Choose
some of the lyrics get posted. She's unhinged. She needs to tone it down a notch. Okay?
some of them.
She's in her fucking unhinged era.
I love it. It's great. She's a tortured poet, man.
I hate you so much. All right, we have a fun Strat Chat for you guys today. We basically branded this the top three mistakes that are costing you money. And I think one of the big ways that we want to outline this is to demonstrate that a lot of these mistakes are incredibly subtle, but they come from the root principle of just kind of like misapplying how we make money in this game. So basically, we were talking to the guys at GTO Wizard, and they put out this ebook that's called Daily Dose of GTO. And we come through it yesterday. It's fantastic, by the way. Tombis, I can't say enough good stuff about him.
I think if there's anybody who really understands how to put complex concepts into very simple terms, Tom Bossoff, very, very good at that.
He's so remarkable. When I went to the credits to see like who had constructed all of this, I expected there to be like 36 people that contributed.
Yeah.
No, it's him.
Yeah.
It's him just making a 1,300-page ebook.
Yeah. And it's basically a compilation of him coming up with the Daily Dose of GTO for like multiple years in a row for Wizard now. But it's also a bunch of stuff on top of that. And like you say, it's 1,300 pages.
Yeah.
Like, it's wild.
I mean, it's not all concept. A lot of it's quizzes and
like
spots.
Sure, reading Lord of the Rings.
Right. but a lot of it's like quizzes and spots for you to practice this stuff. But I wanted to highlight a few that myself and Matt kind of cherry-picked. I think specifically Brian and Conrad and Guapo can contribute a lot to this segment because I think for us, we're constantly in the thick of it when it comes to creating content and coaching. So this stuff is all so second nature, right? But even being second nature, some of these things jumped out at me as like, wow, that is such a great reframe. Like such a fantastic way to reframe the way that we view how money is transferred in this game. And the first one that jumped out at me, I kind of sent it to Landon as a meme because Landon's Mr. No, wrong, blunder, you can't do that, like, that's not a thing, yada, yada, yada. And, you know, sometimes that's true, that people are just, like, blatantly going against their best incentives in the actions that they take. But most often, it's just not true in the sense that they're applying the principle correctly. They may just be inaccurate on one of the details. Like, maybe they miss-size by some degree, right? Like they go medium instead of small, or they go small but on the upper boundary of small, like B40 instead of 25, something like that. Or they get their frequencies like way wrong, right? So like maybe something is like a very, very, very low frequency three bet or a very low frequency check raise, and we just see them doing it too frequently. Mm-hmm. That's a really clear separator, in my opinion, is if the principle is correct, then it's not a mistake. It may be an inaccuracy, right? Mm-hmm. So there's the principle and then there's the mechanic. If you get the principle correct, you could not have made a mistake. You very likely are just inaccurate on the mechanic.
Right.
Right. And that's a big, a big qualifier, I think, through which people can start to see the game a little bit differently. So effectively, when we're talking about a pure mistake, we're saying something that loses against a theoretical strategy, against a baseline strat. So in other words, you've made an adjustment in your, or you made a deviation in such a way that you're no longer adhering to a plus EV decision. You've foregone that EV to do something else. That is going to be a pure mistake, right? But a frequency mistake is just like, okay, you have a hand that mixes and you took a pure action,
right?
You have a hand that's supposed to check sometimes and bet sometimes, but you always check it.
Right. And theoretically, as we saw on the slide there, your opponent can figure that out and exploit it. It is exploitable if they adapt their strategy. But if you're still taking an action that is incentivized to some degree at equilibrium, you're not losing until they adapt.
Right.
So the difference there is you're losing before they adapt versus you're losing after they adapt.
Correct. And I think that's where the rubber really meets the road, right? When we're talking about forcing your opponents to recognize frequency errors or recognize inaccuracies within your game and then exploit them, that's a big leap. And I think that that's where I think that's where a lot of the conversation is both started from and generated from, but also where people start talking past one another, right? So everybody who is shouting from the rooftops that like, oh, GTO doesn't apply to my game, or these fucking solver nerds are ruining the game, and like, shout out to the real OGs that aren't wasting their time studying and doing all it, well, it's like, if you're winning, you're doing principled things, period, right? Like, sure, maybe somebody who's never looked at a sim is going to miss size a bit, or they're going to be a little inaccurate with their frequencies. But if they're winning, they're doing the thing that is heavily incentivized by a theoretical strategy. So I think like the big takeaway then becomes, oh, well, we have freedom to not mix. And I'm staunchly in this camp. Like, I do not mix live. Ever. I'll let the cat out of the bag. If you can figure out which hands I'm bucketing into pure checks and which hands I'm bucketing into pure bets when I am supposed to be having those hands in both actions, God bless you. You know, God bless. But that's just not going to happen. So the thing about live is that it's so incredibly slow. There's almost no incentive outside of peace of mind to execute some sort of mixed strategy. Which then leads us back to, okay, well, just follow the incentive of the hand and understand that you do have two counteracting strategies in every single node. Like, you do have a checking strategy. You do have a betting strategy. All of your hands should fit into both. However, if you cherry pick your hands that mix and put some of them in just bets and some of them in just checks, well, then the onus is on your opponent to do something about it. Right? And how the fuck are they going to figure it out? They're not data scraping you. They don't have a sample of millions of hands to run through some sort of GTO like check, be it PT4 or GTO Wizard to examine you. Right? They're never going to be privy to this information. You can outwardly tell them that that you don't mix, right? Yeah. How are they going to figure out what hands are doing? All they're going to know is that, like, oh, this guy probably always fucking bets his sets. Because, like, you know, if ever there's a hand that's supposed to mix that clearly falls into one camp versus the other, it's going to be, like, the nuts.
Right. And the other thing about it is, a lot of the time, the only effect that's going to be created by playing every hand pure on earlier streets is it's going to alter the amount of board coverage you have on later streets.
Right.
So let's say, for example, if you were to play all your Fantastic Four suited connectors pure as a 3-bet pre, you're not going to have those hands when you call anymore.
Right.
So it's going to change the amount of board coverage you have on those low boards. But the effect that that's actually going to have on your opponent's strategy is going to be pretty hard for them to predict. Like, they might know, okay, well, if you're three betting all your suited connectors, well, now you don't have two pair on these boards. You don't have as many straights. Sure. But what does that mean? Does it mean they get to play their pocket pairs like way more aggressively? Does it mean they have to play aces just a little bit more aggressively? Like, what does it actually do to their strategy? Even if they know exactly what you're doing and you're playing those combos pure,
I would assume finding four betting more, no?
Well, it possibly, but you're also, if you're three betting those hands pure, you're going to have more hands in your pre-flop three betting range that could theoretically call a four bet. So it's going to alter their four bet strategy as well, right? So it's not just a question of one specific node being affected by it. So right. basically, like on the earlier streets, exploits are incredibly hard, is what I'm saying.
I agree with you.
And it's not always easy to predict.
If
what the
somebody
right
would give you that
is.
Game plan, that sort of game plan of like, okay, well, my preflop range, I take mixed candidates and I take pure action with them, right? If somebody were to give you that game plan, the way that you can use that to exploit them is mostly going to be on rivers. Because what will end up happening is once the board is fully complete, now some of those hands that are supposed to exist either as value or bluffs are just devoid.
Right.
Which is now going to sway them heavily in one camp or the other. Right. If they're just totally devoid of 16 combos of value that are supposed to be there, then they're probably over bluffing in this spot. If they're totally devoid of 16 combos of bluffs that are supposed to be there, well, then they're probably like heavily in the camp of being too value heavy. Right. And that's the beauty of live poker. Because that's what we're trying to intuitively figure out in real time. Like, does this guy actually possess enough bluffs the way we landed here on the river? And the less studied they are, the more often you're just going to say, like, probably not, right? Unless they're maniacs. And that's why we, instead of diving really deep into the data when we're playing live, we invest a lot in our ability to assess a human being. We invest a lot in the different archetypes that exist and the pattern recognition that each one fits, right? Old man coffee type, doesn't really bluff enough, don't pay rivers, right? Young kid with a backpack, sunglasses, and headphones, probably at least attempts to bluff at proper frequencies. Go ahead and bluff catch him, right? And then there's the whole spectrum in between. There's the drunk guy at the far end. There's the passive, the loose passive person somewhere in between, right? And we just lean on all of these things to create deviations in our strategies with hands that are supposed to mix. So when we have bluff catchers and we say like, okay, this hand calls sometimes, it folds sometimes, what's going to be my weighted coin? And it's going to be like, oh, it's the person I'm up against. How probable are they to actually have the proper constructed range necessary to allow me to pay or to allow me to give up? And you know, that's why it won't die.
It all comes full circle back to playing the man, not the cards.
So there was a follow-up question to this idea of like, what's the point of mixing, right? And I think this is a really important one to explain, because it's not just it's not necessarily just a definition to advocate for mixing, but it also better identifies why you actually don't have to mix in environments where people have almost no sample on you. So the question is, why do solvers mix their strategies? Why not just use the same action each time? And it could be more than one of these. So pull the room. Like, we can start with LaManna and then go Conrad Guapo. Of these, which do you think, just give one answer.
I mean, probably A, to gain more EV. That's the true goal of you know, trying to play the best, right? To gain the most EV.
Okay, Conrad? Guapo.
I can barely say.
I would go with to remain unexploitable. Okay. Actually, it's, yeah, I would go with that.
I mean, it's probably all of them, but like,
it's not all of them. No, I can tell you that.
It's either A or B. I'd go with B.
Okay. I'll tell you this and then you guys can reevaluate. B is one of them.
Yeah.
There's one more.
Okay, well, it's got to be A.
Why is it not A?
Why is it not A?
Yes.
Oh, it's definitely D.
It's definitely what?
D.
Yes, it's definitely D.
Oh,
I read it wrong.
So why is it not A?
I read it too quick.
Why is it not to gain more EV?
Don't ask me. I thought it was A.
Oh. I'm drawing a blank.
Well, with mixed strategies...
I guess with mixed strategies, then it's
the EV's the same.
We've already,
established
that they're not gaining EV by changing the mixes, right?
Right. So it's to remain unexploitable, right? Which, as we kind of mentioned, isn't really a concern in the live realm if you're executing good strategies. If you're executing poor strategies, which is kind of like what we were talking about, we were reminiscing, people executed such poor strategies that they would be totally devoid of certain things. And those poor strategies made them heavily exploitable, right? If we can say with confidence, where the range ends and like, okay, this is bottom of this guy's range and I can't beat bottom of his range, I always have a fold. Always.
If I didn't mute the chat, I would have definitely just saw that slide before we put it up there and I would have got the answer right.
There you go. This is your penance for not being in the group chat. Okay, so that's why it's not to gain more EV, right? Because you can't gain more EV since it's zero actions. Why is it not to become harder to play against? Because I think this is a big fallacy too. People think that mixed strategies are harder to play against than pure strategies. Why is that not true?
I'm sure.
So the simple reason why that's not true is because your opponent doesn't have clairvoyance over your strategy.
Yeah, that's true.
He can't see what's pure and what's mm-hmm. mixed.
What is the difference between what you just said and B, to remain unexploitable?
So
I'm not sure I don't understand the difference.
Remaining unexploitable means there's nothing your opponent can do. Like if you're executing the proper frequencies, there's nothing your opponent can do to gain EV. If you execute a pure strategy where a mixed one is incentivized, your opponent can counter you by purely responding, right? So if you have a hand that, let's say you have a value bet, but it has to check some of the time to protect your other hands, right? But you just choose to always bet it. Your opponent could now pure fold all of his bluff catchers because you're never bluffing, right? When you're in that particular spot. So you become exploitable, right? C is to play to become harder to play against. Well, B,
right, that's what I was having trouble. Right.
For you to become exploitable, your opponent has to have the knowledge that you are exploitable. So he has to have the clairvoyance to see where you're making frequency errors. That can only happen with data. That's kind of the point, right? So mixing is really only important online because you have to protect your data. You have to have a data set that doesn't skew so heavily one way or the other that somebody can look at it and say like, oh, over 10,000 hands, he doesn't river probe enough. Therefore, when he bets, he's too nutted, right? That doesn't happen live. So you're not any tougher or easier to play against. If anything, you might be easier to play against if you mix too much live.
And this is the reason you say you never mix, because it's just silly.
To me, it's an exercise in futility.
In enough hands with these people that you're playing with.
Exactly. Okay. To me, it's just an exercise in futility. They're always going to be guessing what I'm doing with my range as long as I have a complete range. So it doesn't really make a difference if I'm executing proper mixes or not. Now, the tougher the competition, the more I need to balance that, right?
You also do kind of mix like on player, like per player.
Correct. The tougher my competition, the more I'll check back protected, right? But again, I'm still probably not mixing at the hand level. I'm just mixing at the global strategy level. So in other words, instead of range betting a spot that I would take against a fish, I might execute like a 30% check back with my range. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the individual candidates where like maybe queen 10 is supposed to check back 30% of the time and jack 10 is supposed to check back like half the time, I might just always check back jack 10 and never check back queen 10. But it's impossible for them to realize that.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There's also like an interesting dynamic that you can identify when it comes to what perspective you're looking at on your own strategy. So if you're looking at your strategy from the perspective of everybody else at the table,
mm-hmm.
they might perceive you to have a fairly mixed strategy because they collectively are seeing you three bet a certain frequency.
Exactly. Yep.
And they don't see exactly which hands you're three betting with. But against a specific player, you're only three betting these hands, and against a different player, you're only three betting other mm-hmm. hands. But to the collective environment, your frequency appears fairly mixed because they can never have a sample to actually understand exactly what's doing what.
I think that's like one of the most elegant points because we talk about this a lot where simplification is so heavily incentivized, basically because your opponents can't collect enough information on you and they can never be clairvoyant. Mm-hmm. So playing a single size strategy across all streets is just like the best way to instantly gain win rate, mm-hmm. right? Because it's so much more simple for you to execute as a player. And I talk about often, both with Hunt and others, that like I personally have always preferred to play a multiple size strategy over every single street. But the caveat to that is I'm still only selecting a single size. I just have multiple sizes available. So for instance, Ace King 5 Rainbow against anybody competent, I'm only playing 3E. Mm-hmm. Right, in a single race pot. But against the rest of the pool, I'm going to play B25 and just range bet, right? So now, to the populace, they see that I both play 3E and B25 on Ace-King-5 rainbow. So effectively now, I have a mixed strategy between two sizings. But in practice, depending upon which opponent I'm up against, I only have a single size.
Now one of your opponents is going to see you B25 on an Ace-King-5 against them. They're going to be like, oh, he doesn't think I'm confident.
That's what I was just about to say. I was like, funny because you can observe this sometimes, right? You can see certain things where, and this is, we've talked about this before, where now we've come to the point where certain actions, it's like a disrespectful thing, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Where...
Oaken's going to be like, why is he B25?
Right. I was just about to say, Oaken only gets the 25 range. Exactly.
It's like now, it used to be like, disrespectful fold, disrespectful bluff or whatever. Now it's disrespectful sizing.
Yes,
it's like, we're going to pick a size that we know is not the right size, but you're a fish, so I'm going to size wrong. I'm going to deliberately size wrong against you.
Yeah, the blatant non-sizing.
Yeah.
Is whenever you like
the custom size.
The second you like, if you're a studied player or observant at all and get hit with a non-size by somebody else that you think is good, you should just instantly expect or believe that they think you have a hole in your game at that exact node.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because like if they hit you with 67% in a spot where they're supposed to just like jam for 2x pot or check back, then what they're basically saying is like, I think you only have weak hands.
Yeah.
In this particular area, so I'm just going to try to maximize.
Or like, yeah. I think you're drastically overfolding to this size, yes, or something like
one
that.
One or the other.
Like, but there's some sizes are like, fuck you sizes.
Exactly, 100%.
It's like, this is a size where a good player would only use this size if they think you're punting against this size.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. Absolutely. Or yeah, like the induce raise size. Even though inducing isn't really a thing, it's like, if you actually are to the point where you're so kind of knowledgeable of your opposition's game that you're like thinking along the same lines as mm-hmm. them, then you just hit them with the size where it's just like, I know exactly what the reaction to this
you know
is.
What the ultimate fuck you size is? It's the small bet in position on the river. It's like the
B25
the B25 in position on river, because that's saying you aren't even remotely capable of check raising the river. It's like, I'm going to value bet third pair for thin value because you are completely incapable of check raising.
Yeah.
Right.
Or like you're just totally incapable of calling a large bet here. So I actually have to get you to do the work for me.
Oh, like I'm going to induce. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I'm just going to bet all my value here for a quarter. And you're going to call either way too wide, or you're just going to have some hands that are just like, I don't believe this.
Some guy got me with that last year. Like some guy got me with I had profiled him as being a fish when maybe he was, maybe he wasn't, I don't know, but he got me with like, he bet one big blind in position on the river into like a 15 big blind pot.
Okay.
And I check raised and he just snaps with like the second nuts and I'm like, oh my God, he got me. He got me. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe he got me.
Yeah. If you have them pegged as a fish, that is probably a get you size.
Yeah, it was.
Almost
it got
always.
Me. Absolutely got me.
Yeah. So the final, I guess, takeaway, at least from the slides, for this is, and I think this is like something you guys can take to the bank. You should just like really set this to your memory. More importantly, not to execute in real time, but like when it comes to transitioning your study into your gameplay, these are nuggets that are like really worth putting in your memory bank, because it puts your eye on the ball. It makes you aware of like the things that you should be thinking about, which are the principles that drive your strategies, as opposed to nailing the frequency, nailing the mix correctly, right? So effectively, frequency mistakes are not punished by a GTO strategy. However, they are exploitable by somebody who has knowledge over the deviations that you're making. That means that you need to mix appropriately in order to construct an unexploitable range in every line, if that is important. But as we kind of outlined in live, it just absolutely is not. So the solver will be capable of making full use of the game tree to construct the most efficient, least exploitable lines. And the more complex the game trees, the more mixing that will tend to take place. What's most important here is like, and this is what I kind of highlighted in my tweet, solvers will give you the picture of what this game looks like at rest. So if we were to take two perfect models and put them up against one another, the image that we get back from the sim that we just ran is going to be what the game looks like the day that you should hang them up and say, okay, I now retire, right? And what you can extrapolate from that is all of the unnecessary, I guess, like nuance that isn't needed in order to win, right? Like the second that you see, you know, a particular hand is meant to check back at a high frequency in spite of being like one of your highest equity hands. And the whole reason for this is that your opponents are supposed to check raise like 27% frequency. Well, the second that you look at their strategy and you highlight their check raises and you see that they're supposed to come from like, you know, one over, one under with a backdoor straight draw. That's and like, you just say like, oh, this
really obscure stuff.
Yeah, like, yeah. Like they're supposed to have like 9-4 suited on like 7-6 deuce. And you're just like, okay, I've never seen that hand check raise in my life. Mm-hmm. We can eliminate that one. And then you start to bucket all the hands around it that are supposed to be taking this action at like really high frequency. And you just say, my opponents just aren't ever doing this. Well, it's like, once that becomes the case, then we can go back to the principal level and say like, okay, if they're not aggressing enough, what door does that open for me? And the simple answer is I get to aggress more, right? Mm-hmm. Like that's always going to be the case. The more passively your opponents respond, the more aggressively you can value own them street over street over street. And you can't let the traps deter you, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, yes, they're too passive in every portion of their strategy, which includes hands that are just supposed to be funneling money in for value. The way that you win is you're extracting so much value from the middle to bottom of their range that now they're losing value for the top.
Yeah, that's good to know because like, it can be frustrating,
of
right?
Of course.
It is because you're just like, you're just betting, bet, and then they just roll over like such a strong hand, like, would you just bet your hand like right. the way you're supposed to bet your hand so I can fold? But right. now you're just so passive that I have to play my other hands like that are like mediocre.
The thing is, though, value, even the additional money that you put in with those hands mm-hmm. is still so much less than what they could have earned
right.
if they exactly. had bloated the pot themselves.
Exactly. And then all the other times where they're playing everything else passive,
exactly.
you're just printing.
Exactly. So you're just earning so much additional money.
Just in that exact moment, it's frustrating
of
because
course.
You're like, oh, man, like just bet your hand.
But
you
course.
Don't want them to do that because that would make them a better player.
Well, you want them to do it in an imbalanced way.
Yeah.
You want every right. one of their check raises right. to only be the nuts.
Just sets right? every time.
So that you can just fold yeah. always.
Right.
And sometimes that does become the case.
Yeah.
But what you don't want them to do is find some semblance of balance.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want them to have like the nuts and open enders.
Right.
Because now you're just like, fuck.
I guess maybe like a lot of times they do play like their sets where they do check raise and it's easy just to fold. But then it's like they have ace king on an ace high board and they just check call three streets.
Yeah.
And you're like, I have ace seven here. I'm just betting. I have to have the best hand.
Right. But right. Again, even that becomes like an easy tweak for you because now it's like, oh, okay, well, if that's what they're showing up with in their bluff catching region,
mm-hmm.
then this allows me to both bluff more often when I block these types of hands.
Right.
And be more cautious about value betting too thin mm-hmm. because they're probably not showing up with enough middle pair.
Exactly.
Yeah. And yeah, man, like that's just the beauty of live. Like these mistakes are so subtle because the big mistake that's made here off of something so tiny, right? Like we're talking about like mixing frequencies and shit that people just don't even consider live. But the big mistake is falling victim to the observation bias, right? The big mistake is, oh, my opponents always have it. Therefore, I can never bluff catch. I can never value bet thin enough, right? They're missing the forest for the trees. The takeaway is that they respond too passively. Therefore, I can aggress much, much more frequently, right? And that's the area where we earn all of our money, but it's very undisclosed, as you kind of mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
All of those uncontested pots that you drag, they add up.
Right, yeah, for sure.
You know, those are many big blinds over hundreds of hands, mm-hmm. right? But it's difficult because you just lose a stack whenever you flop top pair good kicker versus top in a yeah. single raise pot.
Right.
It's like, well, fuck me.
Yeah.
But it's like, okay, that happens.
Yeah.
No big deal. Let's just move on. Okay. So one of the other small principles that I wanted to identify, and I think this is a really key one to zone in on because it's very applicable to multi-way as well. And this is about like realizing equity. So the next two quiz questions we have are about equity realization and over-realizing your equity. So this first one, It's going to apply very often to you in multi-way spots where you're the defender. And it's just about understanding when you have too much equity to ever fold your hand, right? So in this particular instance, the question is, and again, this is a heads-up scenario, which will just over-exaggerate it, but this will be very applicable to multi-way as well, because certain hands are just too robust in their ability to show down and win or to improve that you can't really ever fold them. If the cutoff opens and the button calls and the flop is 9-8-7-2 diamonds, which hand has the best equity realization for the opener who's out of position now?
A.
So A6 of diamonds on 9-8-7-2 diamonds.
You're basically asking, like, which one do you want to, like, check back a lot? Or?
No, you're out of position.
Oh, you're out of position. Sorry. Yeah.
But it's basically what you're asking is which one is just always going to realize its equity and then some. So it's never folding, basically.
Oh, gotcha.
So is it A6 of diamonds on 9 of hearts, 8 of diamonds, 7 of diamonds? B, ace-9 with the ace of diamonds? C, kings, no diamond? Or D, 8-7 of spades for bottom two?
Another, sorry, Connie, to...
I just buzzed in, bro. You
already answered.
Did you ever see that? Like, you never watched an American TV show? Like, yeah. Jeopardy or something? And then the other people don't talk, man.
You already gave your answer.
My God. All right, the answer is A. Go on, Hunt.
Yeah, there you go. The way I like to look at equity realization is it's basically if everything was checked down compared to if you actually incorporate decision-making across multiple streets. So which of these hands benefits the most from actually having both players make decisions relative to if it was to check down?
Right.
That's the way to frame this question or the way to look at it.
Yeah.
I thought about it as which hand would I prefer to have?
Yes, that's a good way of thinking about it as well.
Which hand can the board change on the turn and I'm not putting in the muck?
Right, because kings is like kind of scary. Bottom two is kind of scary.
10, 5, diamond rolls off on the turn.
A6 of diamonds.
Cards just goes in the muck.
Okay, so A6 of diamonds is clearly the one that realizes its equity the most. Mm-hmm. But there's another hand that over-realizes its equity as well.
Ace-9 of diamonds?
It's not ace-9.
Ace-9
of diamonds, obviously.
Ace-9 with the ace of diamonds.
With the ace of diamonds? What do you guys think? Maybe?
That's what I would have went with because of the ace of diamonds.
Okay. Lamanna?
Yeah, I do kind of like that because like if a diamond rolls off...
You could still make the nuts.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Hunt, do you want a fair guess or do you already know the answer?
I don't know the answer. I think in terms of which has the best equity realization. Yeah, I think it's probably the ace of diamonds 9. I definitely think kings is at the bottom.
Kings is definitely at the bottom.
I think it's going to be close between ace of diamonds 9 and 8-7 of spades. Yeah. But I think ace of diamonds 9 is probably it's probably over-realizing more because it doesn't have as much equity as 8-7 to start with. And it's going to occasionally, because it has the ace of diamonds, it's going to bluff on certain runouts. Mm-hmm. So that's going to, I think, help it over-realize. I think it's going to be big.
I think it's overwhelmingly D, if I had to guess.
I think it might be D if there's a spade on board.
Yeah.
If the heart is a spade, I think it's D.
Yeah, that's fair. And I just think that though 8-7 is very vulnerable, it is...
It doesn't fold much.
Yeah, it's just... It also can bluff whenever it gets counterfeit as well.
Oh, wow.
Oh, it's clearly 8-7. Yeah, wow.
Yeah.
Holy shit.
Yeah. Yeah, so actually, kings is greater than ace-9 with the ace of diamonds.
Wow, that's really surprising.
I imagine it has part to do with you blocking the nut flush draw as well. So like you block hands like ace-4 of diamonds, ace-3 of diamonds, which isn't really great when it comes to the... Like, now you're funneling them more into stronger hands.
Yeah.
More into combo draws and better
pairs. I guess it's really just a question of 8-7 being a hand where when the board does run out favorably... We get two streets of value, right? Like,
but it's also a matter of their range, right? We have to remember this is a button defense range, so 8-7 blocks all of their sets, with the exception
of
nines,
that's very true.
Right? So there are just like a lot of hands that ace-9's dead against, where 8-7 just won't be.
That was a cool hand,
and that's the big thing about ace-6 of diamonds is it's never dead,
right?
Mm. It can't get turned dead, but like it's never dead on the flop, whereas a hand like kings, I was surprised the kings. I would have said the same as you. I would have thought ace-9 would outperform kings.
Yeah, I think we all like leveled ourselves. I think we all...
I was like, I'm never folding ace-9.
Well, we all thought that two pair would be the most obvious answer. So I think we all were like, well, maybe it probably isn't the two pair. Like maybe we go the ace of diamonds being more significant. But yeah, I guess it just two pair over realizes more than.
Yeah, I think the thing to take away here is that raw equity is always going to overcome playability.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, right? Like because
when you have a strong hand, it's really good.
Right. Exactly.
Well,
exactly.
I guess the way I'm looking at it though, or the way that we should look at equity realization is about how much raw equity you have in comparison to, you know, what the playability is, right? So we're basically what I'm saying is we're already incorporating how much raw equity 8-7 suited has into it's baked into the calculation of our EQR, of our equity realization. So mm-hmm. It's easy to think, well, this hand has more equity, therefore it realizes more equity, but it is possible for a hand to be high equity but struggling to realize that equity.
I think that's like kings.
Vice versa. Yeah, that's what I mean. Like, yeah. I think that if you actually looked at the baseline equity of kings, ace nine with the ace of diamonds, and 8-7 suited, I think 8-7 suited would probably only be 3 or 4% ahead of those other two hands. Mm-hmm. But I guess because of the two pair, because of the blocking sets, it over realizes much more.
Yeah, and the ability to improve.
Yeah.
Like it can actually improve versus Jack 10 where mm-hmm. Kings and Ace 9 really don't.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. I didn't even.
So yeah, I think that it comes down to basically your opponent's range and the board texture with regard to, how it can change. You know, if we saw a very dry texture, this would flip things, completely. If this were like 9 deuce deuce, the answers would become like obviously very Kings. Different. Like, if this were 9 deuce deuce 2 diamonds, like, right. Black Kings is so far beyond ace-6 of diamonds.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
You know?
Funny, what were you were about to say?
No,
something?
No. I was like, I didn't realize that either.
Yeah.
You can just have the nuts on the turn.
Mm-hmm. Or on the flop. Oh, you're saying 8-7.
Yeah, we can just drill a boat. And then
yeah, right.
Did he completely cross my... Did
worth a lot. Conrad never improves with two pair. Yeah. He's like, motherfucker, I can get counterfeit. It's like, you can also make a boat.
It literally didn't even cross my mind. So sick.
Conrad's a worst case scenario kind of
right.
guy.
Right, yeah, exactly.
It's easier to make a boat than it is to get counterfeit.
That is true.
That is true. Okay, so this next one, again, I think is going to apply multi-way. And maybe all that will happen is these percentages tweak a little bit, but it's very important to understand because it allows you to really understand the importance of position and how much it alters our ability to remain aggressive. So though we were kind of saying earlier, like passive responses allow us to aggress a lot more, that becomes a little bit untrue out of position. The more passive the imposition player is, the more incentivized we are to continue to check because we just get to see more streets and realizations like the number one hurdle that out of position has to try to overcome.
Right.
The big thing that out of position struggles with is actually getting to the river, getting to showdown. So the question then becomes, you open two big blinds from the hijack, the button calls and the blinds fold. How often should you c-bet on this flop on the flop on average? So it's over the aggregate of all flops.
This one for me was super easy because if they would have given me an option for like 1%, I would have taken that one.
Okay, interesting. So you're on A, I assume for 20.
Yeah.
What about you, Hunt?
I think it's 30, probably. I would have guessed about 35, so 30 or 40.
I actually know this one specifically because Jeremiah and I talked about it, but I won't spoil. What do you think?
I'm going B.
You're going B, Lamanna?
With hijack versus button, I think you can see bet more often in that formation than it would be like a earlier open and an earlier call. So
that's a good point.
I'm going with D.
You're going with D?
D. Let's elaborate a little bit on like if it's say low jack versus hijack. Why do you think that that's a lower c-bet frequency?
Just because the ranges are tighter, they're gonna have stronger hands. You're gonna be up against stronger hands.
Yeah, that's partially true, but you have to think it's only pre-flop, right?
Right.
It's over the aggregate of all flops.
Yeah.
So you know, it does kind of adjust a little bit. I think the reason why they took hijack first button is because that's like the average position that you could find. I would imagine if you tightened the out of positions range, so if this were like under the gun 9 versus button, I would imagine the c-bet frequency would increase small, but not much. The answer is B.
Yeah.
Mm. So it's going to be 30%.
I was only off by 20%.
High five.
And this is basically predicated off of like high, low, low paired boards are going to get c-bet a lot. So like king high boards with pairs, queen high boards with pairs, these are going to get c-bet maybe like half the time. And then like, you know, dynamic boards like we just saw on the 987 two-tone, that's going to get c-bet at a very low frequency, maybe like 12%.
One thing that I would say about this, though, is that we should, when we see numbers like this, we shouldn't look at them as being an absolute because it's a function of the game tree. So in this case, you can see the game tree has bet 33, 50, 75, 125, and all in. Now, if that 33 was replaced with like a one big blind bet or bet 20 or bet 25, that frequency for betting that size may go up, because we're getting a better price to use that size.
Yeah.
So in every situation where you're looking at a report like this, you always have to look at what is the smallest size that the player is allowed to bet. Because if we hypothetically gave this player a game tree where they're not allowed to bet less than half pot, that c-bet frequency would probably go down to like 10%.
Right.
So, and conversely, you could theoretically, if you had a smaller size than the 33, you could justify 40% maybe if you used another size.
And that is, that's the really key factor of how this ties into multiway, in my opinion, is that sizing will dictate your frequency a lot. So the smaller the sizes that you're using, the more frequent that you're going to be able to c-bet. And conversely, the more opponents in the hand, the lower the frequency that you get to c-bet because the lower your pot share, right? So two things are driving this strategy. One, your overall equity. And then two, your ability to realize said equity through bets, right? When you're heads up, there will be a lot of board textures where your overall share of the pie, your equity distribution, is going to be relatively high, even compared to a tight button calling range. And you're going to get to c-bet a lot more frequently, kind of like we were talking about, like the high, low, low paired boards, things of that nature.
I have a quick question.
Yeah, go
Why
ahead.
Do you think it's a, and I don't know if this is a common practice, but I've always, from what I've seen, a simplified strat is just to tell people you're doing just fine if you're checking like almost 100% of the time.
I can feel that one.
Yeah.
I think it's because there will be a large number of flops where your out of position c-bet strategy is basically mixing c-bets with almost every combo in your range.
Right.
So there's going to be very few
More importantly, mixing checks with every combo.
Yes,
in your range.
Exactly. Yeah.
And am I correct in stating that in a lot of when you're teaching people how to play, that it is a common practice to just simplify and say, hey, like you'll be doing just fine. Just checking.
I think that is a good starting point. But I think you, these days at least, I think you fairly quickly get to a point where the amount of EV that you gain just by having a rudimentary understanding of how to build a c-bet range from out of position is reasonably significant. So I think that once you are, if you're playing, you know, opponents who are making mistakes on the passive side, you certainly start to lose a lot from not being able to bet from out of position.
This goes back to our initial discussion of why do we bother mixing. There are very few actions we can take that are so transparent that our opponent knows for a fact what our strategy is, but pure checking out of position is one of them, right? If we are pure, if they play enough pots in position versus us and we just don't really ever c-bet against them, even over a sample of like 20 hands, if we never c-bet, it means we aren't mixing. And if we aren't mixing, we become exploitable, right? That's the clear and obvious answer. The reason to mix is not because it matters much about EV, but because specifically we become very exploitable. So now our simplified strategy can be exploited by in position taking deviations, knowing that we're checking our full range. Now, to Matt's point, the way that we could potentially be losing EV is if you have a poor understanding of what the out of position strategy is, because there will be some hands that pure bet, right? Like if we potentially have a pure bet on, call it 9-4 deuce rainbow with a set of fours, and we fail to bet that hand, it's now losing EV by being bucketed into our checking range. And now we're also being exploited by the in position player who maybe gets to check back too frequently and, you know, cost us a lot with the top of our range, or, you know, potentially stab too frequently if we have too many give ups on a board texture like this, right? So it really comes down to navigating the hands within the strategy that actually are pure one way or the other. And I think that most of the simplification, much like the range bet simplification, is born out of the extremities of board textures, right? So when we get 987 two-tone, that board can be like pure checked and we're not giving anything up because there's probably no pure bets on that particular texture.
We're going to mix high frequency check with everything there anyway.
Exactly.
So there's a lot of board textures where if you check your entire range, you lose nothing because every hand is checking a lot anyway.
Right.
But there's also a bunch of board textures where checking your entire range actually becomes quite a bit worse than just range betting.
Correct.
Because your range is predominantly composed of hands that favor betting, and forcing yourself to check those hands now gives up quite a lot of EV.
Right. So by checking 987, you lose no EV, but you become exploitable. By pure range betting a board texture like King Deuce Deuce, you may gain no EV and probably don't become that exploitable because it's not that obvious that you never check these particular boards because you do check out of position some of the time. So it's assumed that you have some checks. But when you drill down and you look at the King Deuce Deuce, the reason why we can range bet there is because we have so many hands that are pure bets, right? And now checking in if we aren't mixing and we just default to a check, we're making a massive error with all of these hands that are meant to be pure bets.
Right.
They're all giving up EV. And there are probably no hands that pure check or very, very, very few. So by simplifying to a range bet, we don't give anything up, right? And it works in the inverse. Whenever we have hand or when we have ranges that never have a pure bet, of course we don't give up any EV by now pure checking. But we tip our strategy to our opponents. That becomes the biggest issue.
I think you basically have, from at least the way I approach it, is from out of position, you have three strategies. You have range check, range bet, and split. And identifying which one you're going to use in any given spot makes your whole life a lot easier. Because if you can have a decent chunk of boards for a certain formation, it's like, these are my range bet boards.
Mm-hmm.
These boards are my range check boards. And then the boards in the middle where you're splitting, you focus your energy on, how do I split? What's my size going to be? What are my bet hands? What are my check hands going to be? And so on and so forth.
Yeah. And that this slide just kind of dumbs it down a little bit, basically saying.
That's amazing.
Well, I mean, you know, they're not digging into like pure versus.
Some of us need these, all right?
Pure versus mix. But basically, you're saying like, you know, when the button calls, we're not in a position of strength any longer, mainly because we're sacrificing position.
Right.
But secondarily, because we just will generally have less EV than if it were against the big blind who has a much wider range. So we have to be respectful of that and execute a checking strategy. I'm not really sure that I play pure range bet very often out of position unless the player is incredibly weak.
I think that with the depth of stacks that you play at, it probably makes sense not to do that.
That's true.
Because
MTT things would be very different.
For tournaments, there's a bunch of spots where you're like 50 big blinds deep and the button call range is relatively wide because there's a big blind ante.
Mm.
So when it comes like ace queen jack or something, you can range bet small because they have so many pocket pairs that just fold.
Right. Yeah. That makes a ton of sense.
You don't get those spots in 1,000 big blind deep cash or whatever.
Right. Because those pairs just don't fold. they can't, right? They have such high implied odds,
right,
that peeling one off and just drilling a two out of there is like worth a lot of money. Okay, let's get to this final one, and it basically outlines EV, and I think that this one's critically important because most people aren't really thinking about EV when they're in game, and the issue is they're probably not thinking about it much when they're studying either. People tend to study at a bit of a too nuanced level, and they just kind of default to believing that they understand EV, where it comes from, how it's generated, how it's exchanged, and everything else. And I would say that we probably do a lot of heavy lifting by zooming out a bit and keeping the context of EV in the forefront of our minds more frequently. So this example is 6 max cash, 100 big blinds. There's an open to 2.5 big blind, the small blind 3 bets to 12. You call the button with King 10 suited. And man, this is such a good one because I don't think a lot of people would get this right. Like,
I want to take a shot. I want to be the first one to take a guess
here. Okay. And also in the chat, throw up your answers, what you guys believe it to be, because I think this is going to be a mixed bag. I think we're going to get a lot of responses. So the EV of calling the 3-bet with King 10 suited is 1.41 big blinds. What is the expected value of your stack after calling the 3-bet? So in other words, you call the 3-bet, the hand plays out to completion. What is the return on your stack? What's your final stack after this hand ends based off of this measurement?
So the first thing I thought of was calling with King 10 suited obviously is making money because it says you're making 1.41.
Yes.
And then I thought maybe it's sort of a trick question because your stack is now, after calling the 3-bet, is you have 88.
Mm-hmm.
So if I guess I'm just adding 1.4 to that, that's the way I'm thinking. The answer is D, 90.
Okay, 90.5. LaManna, you want to venture a guess?
I'm thinking.
I love hot seating you guys.
I know.
Conrad, you're next. Yeah. Don't fucking him and haw when we get to you.
Like I am?
Yes. I don't even care what answer you come up with. I just care more so about the thought process. Like, Guapa did a great job explaining how he arrived at the answer, so I don't even care if it's right or wrong. Like, at least that is that's a line of logic that I can follow.
Right.
You want me to just go right now?
Please, yeah. Let's hear it, Connie.
All right, I'm gonna go C.
Okay.
And that's because monkeys always pick C when they do quizzes, and that's the only good reason I have for you.
No. Come on, I need more than that.
No, I really have no good reason for any of them.
This one's tough. I have or no at least idea. It was tough for me.
Okay.
Zero idea. I would say A because it's the easiest way to get to an answer. It's had 1.41 big blinds on.
Okay, yeah, so
I mean, no, you're not taking a shot here, LaManna?
I mean, A seems like the simplest answer because sometimes the simplest answer is correct.
Why A?
Well, because if it's worth
1.41,
yeah,
and you started with 100.
Started with 100, then okay. That's yeah.
Do you know the answer to this, Hunt?
I think I do, but I'm not 100% confident.
That's fine.
I think it's C.
Okay.
Monkeys.
Explain us why.
Because at the node that we're talking about, which is the node where we're facing the 3-bet,
yes,
we have 97.5 big blinds in our stack.
Correct.
So we fold,
yes.
The right. EV yes. of our right. stack yes. Yes. Yes.
is 97.5.
Good job, excellent right. work.
If we don't fold, we get the additional 1.41 big blinds, which means we go up to 98.91.
This
if
is
I wasn't
so
on the hot seat, I would have eventually.
Sure.
The monkeys always no, get seriously. Things right.
This
man.
Is so. This is such a critical right. Concept to understand it because is. So many people will like coaches are notorious for this. They'll be like, no, you can't fold there. That's making two big blinds, right? What the fuck does that mean?
Right.
The answer is that it's making two big blinds in that node. It always has to be compared to folding, which is the right. alternative.
And that's when I first started like studying preflop charts and these kind of things is that concept exactly. Like that's right. I wasn't joking when I said I would have came
so
to that
conclusion. My thought process wasn't too far off.
It wasn't too far off.
Right.
It missed closing the gap, right? You went all the way to the
after calling.
After
correct.
Calling, right.
Yes, it's correct. Right. You've already jumped the node.
It's the point of the decision.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
You always have to discount everything that's already happened, right?
Yes.
Pretend
that money's all in the pot. It's gone forever.
Exactly. Pretend right. that we don't know how we got here. We're just faced with a decision where our current stack is 97.5 big blinds, and we have the opportunity to take a spot that is plus 1.41 big blinds in EV. That's all you need to know.
So then what do you say to this counter then, Hunt? Now that I understand that, we're winning compared to folding versus a 3-bet, but I'm losing money overall in the play, right?
Mm-hmm.
Why do I 3-bet the hand to begin with?
Wait.
Or sorry. Yeah, yeah.
We
faced the 3-bet. Sorry.
We faced the 3-bet.
Right. Why did I open the hand to begin with?
We opened the hand to begin with because the aggregate of all the things that happens after you open makes it profitable.
Yes. So that's the other part of this that we didn't see. If we had backed this question up as to say... okay, we open King 10 from whatever position.
It was the button, I thought.
Yeah, and the small blind 3-bet, right? Yeah, so we open the King 10 suited 2.5 big blinds on the button, and it's making X. What's our stack, assuming that you know whatever action we face thereafter is passive? It's either a fold or a call. What's our stack then thereafter? And the answer is 100 plus X, right? Whatever it's making. So it's a profitable open, and now it's a profitable defend versus 3-bet. But in between there, we had to obviously lose some EV because we're lower down in our range with King 10 suited than we would be if we had aces.
Yeah.
Right? Aces would go up. We'd just be earning more because more big blinds are going into the middle, right? So the other way you could kind of frame this would be like pot share, but that would be more equity versus EV.
It'd be like, it's why a calling range from the big blind is so wide.
Yeah.
Because it's like, if you fold the big blind, you're losing one big, like if you fold anything.
Be careful about that though, because it's very easy to look at that and look at from the start of the hand, your win rate in the big blind is your negative whatever amount, right? But when you're looking at it in the perspective where you are already in the hand and you are facing the open, folding from that point is zero EV.
Right.
So it's not that you have to, it's not that necessarily that you're...
Calling like loses less.
But this is what I'm saying, though. Calling doesn't lose, calling loses less if you look at it from the beginning of the... From the beginning of the spot before the blinds are put out, let's say, right?
Okay.
If you had a strategy where you never call in the big blind, your strategy would be losing a lot more.
Right.
But when you call in the big blind at that point, when you're faced with that decision, every hand that you're calling with is winning as a call because it wouldn't be a good idea. Like, if it wasn't, it would be better to fold and just take a zero EV fold.
Right.
So you're never defending the big blind with hands which are losing as a defend. But your overall win rate in the big blind will never be positive. It'll be like negative 50 big blinds per 100.
Right.
But that's better than what it would be if you were folding
100%.
Yeah, right. I think you guys are saying the same thing.
Yeah.
It might just not be articulated
as
well.
I didn't want Brian to think that there's some hands that you defend in the big blind that are losing, but you defend them anyway.
Right, it's the exact same as King 10 suited.
No, what I'm saying is that you defend them because... Like if you defend a certain hand because if you just fold, you're losing one big blind. But if you defend it, you're losing 0.9 big blinds.
That's the wrong way to frame it.
Yeah.
If you fold, you're losing zero. If you call, you're winning X.
Okay. Yeah.
And that win rate is now compared
still,
to what
right.
you're losing.
But it's still right. If you do the math, it comes out to be the same.
I didn't want the audience to think that we're looking at it from the beginning
before
we put the blind out.
I understand.
Yeah. Because there's a lot of particularly with big blind ante in tournaments, people are like, well, I already have one big blind out there. It's like, no, you don't. That big blind is not yours anymore.
Right.
It's just a pot. Right. You are getting a price.
Right.
Yeah. It's the exact same as the King 10 node. You're only examining the node you're in. So King 10 is winning 1.41 big blinds versus 3-bet.
Yeah.
Just strictly versus 3-bet.
Well, versus 3-bet from this position.
Yes, correct.
Yeah.
Correct. Right.
Against the 3-bet from a different position, it's going to be winning a different amount.
And it's the same thing with the big blind defense, right?
So like
versus under the gun, 9-8 off is going to perform differently than versus button.
Right. Like if something like you're calling because it's winning more than
folding.
More than one big blind.
Folding is zero at that point.
Folding is zero.
It's winning more than zero.
Right.
Winning more than zero.
It might be winning 0.01.
Right.
But it's and then it's going
to
be winning.
Right.
Yeah. And a lot of that just comes down to like strength of hand and the ability to realize, because obviously position disadvantage here is a bit of a problem.
Right.
And the other thing to understand is, and we're not going to have time to get into this, but the other thing you're speaking to here is like the money that's in the pot. So I think people think of the big blind of like, oh, I'm invested in this pot.
I don't think along those lines.
It's not necessarily wrong to think that way. It's just wrong in the sense of not taking it to the next logical step, which is the pot odds.
Mm-hmm.
Right, you're being laid pot odds. It's not that you have a big blind invested. And you have to
less the call.
Protect that or
it's,
something
it's
like that.
The,
less, it's less the call than it would be in the
exactly,
small blind.
Exactly.
Right.
If you're facing a 2.5x, it's 1.5 big blinds now for you to enter this pot instead of 2.5x. And there's already 1.5 big blinds out there.
Right.
Plus the 2.5. So you're getting like, a little less than 3-1 on a call, as opposed to the button facing a cutoff open who's
it's
getting
as simple
laid
as thinking
price.
Instead of like just think about like if they just dragged the pot in before
immediately.
They got the hand.
Yeah.
Just drag the pot in, they just put it in the middle and you don't have it in front of you. It's not your big blind.
And this
anymore.
Is the reason
but
why I frame it that way.
Now it's one big blind less to call than it would be for everybody else.
Like when tournaments shifted from table ante to big blind ante, this is what happened. That everybody started defending their big blind wider because they thought, well, I've got more money out there. I have to defend my big blind more aggressively.
Right.
But there was never any validity to that. Like, it's not strategically good to change based on who put the ante in. However, it did lead to people not overfolding their big blind as much as they previously
They should have been defending it wider when it was
original. The bottom line is it doesn't matter who put the money out there. And this is always something that I'll just stress in every spot. Like, it doesn't matter, what percentage of the pot you put in versus your opponent or somebody else or whatever. You are in a decision point. There is X in the pot. You are getting a price of whatever. And that's the decision you're faced with. You know, any money that went into the pot, doesn't matter how it got there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's a very good point. All right, I think it's a good place to end. I'm going to head down to the Bellagio and try to put some
Get
of this,
some of this in action. Don't forget that we have a brand new episode of On Second Thought out. You can find that at solveforwhy.io. We also have two academies coming up at the end of May. We have the Cash Academy, which is well over halfway full. We have a few seats remaining for that one. That's May 23rd to the 25th. Then we have the MTT Academy, May 27th through the 30th.
You nailed it!
All right, I got it.
First time.
If you guys are interested in the Academy, you can hit hashtag Academy in the chat, or you can head to academy.solveforwhy.io. If you guys want more of the Daily GTO ebook, go ahead and hit hashtag Daily GTO in the chat, or you can follow the pinned link. It's also in the description below. Big shout out to GTO Wizard. We appreciate you guys, as always, for being the title sponsor of the show. That's going to do it for us. We're going to be back again tomorrow, noon Pacific. Poo Dog will be in the building. You won't want to miss it. We'll see you guys all then.
Peace.
Peace.